I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
Are you guys ready to get warmed up? Because I am.
Have you ever wondered about the history of the sommelier profession? It's something I think about a lot. Some of the earliest sommeliers were slaves in ancient Greece, and it was the slave's job to remove wine from amphora into drinking vessels and to prepare wine for consumption in general. Wine preparation seemed to move into doctor-like territory in ancient Egypt and in Roman Italy, when wine used to be steeped with fruits and healing herbs. Wines steeped with herbs and spices were considered to have healing abilities, and it was often drunk as medicine. Wine was also used on open wounds to disinfect the areas. But as Pasteur and other contributors to 19th century medicine began to unravel the secrets of microorganisms, wine's place in medicine waned. But the revelation of the microworld also drastically transformed how wine can be made in wineries and what wine can ultimately be. But the modern-day sommeliers can find their roots in the Middle Ages in Europe. During feudalism, when nobles would travel, they'd take large caravans from village to village and court to court, kingdom to kingdom. And in the caravans, drawn by animals, different people would be in charge of different cargo. These servants, charged with organization and transport of a particular type of cargo, were called sommeliers. When the caravan stopped, it's possible that royalty continued to call for this or that cargo. The sommelier and the household butler began to cross territories in the 1300s. Butlers selected wines for wealthy households, and many kept records indicating vintage and cost variations. Then things started to shift when the entire system of feudalism began to crumble. With the fall of kingdoms and nobility, and with the rise of humanism and enlightenment, wine stewards ceased to be slaves and servants and serfs and butlers, and they began to be free people working for themselves in a free market. Restaurants are relatively new concepts that arose during the French Revolution. Without castles and courts to supply wine to, consumption moved towards restaurants. Chefs that had cooked for aristocrats who had been killed in the Reign of Terror found themselves out of patronage and out of a job. And a few entrepreneurial chefs opened up public restaurants in Paris in the wake of the French Revolution. In these interesting a la carte restaurants, wine lists began to mimic the a la carte menus, as in many individual selections that could be ordered by the bottle, as opposed to one house wine. Previously, in inns and taverns, people ordered house wine from barrels, and they got whatever mass-produced food was made in the kitchen. But in a la carte restaurants, individual meals were available to order, and soon individual wines were available to order by the bottle. Instead of a mug from a cask, you could order this or that bottle from this or that vintage in a public venue. The appeal of a la carte dining spread throughout the world, and now a la carte dining is the normal way to dine in most countries. This is a pretty incredible social shift, especially considering that the modern-day a la carte restaurant has only been around for about 300 years. As estate bottling came to be the preferred method of packaging wine for transport and consumption, the ability to collect multiple bottles from multiple vintages and producers increased, and by the mid-1900s, there were several professional sommeliers controlling wine cellars around the world. Hotels in big cities often had sommeliers in charge of their wine cellars, and we can find evidence of sommeliers who worked in big New York City hotels in the decade just after Prohibition. The sommelier profession in its modern form is really made possible by two important factors. Number one, by the social shifting that led to the restaurant format of public dining. And number two, the shift in wine trade packaging to estate bottling. How did glass blowers contribute to the standard 750-milliliter bottle format over the last 500 years? Stay tuned for next week's warm-up to find out.
Hey guys, it's Talitha from Vine Wine. 750 has been the greatest revolution to wine buying. in the last 10 years. The ability to be able to go online, search out one item, a Palo Cortado, a new cider, some Chinon, and have all of the answers and the great bottles in front of you in 2 seconds is something that has changed my life. Makes buying easier. I'm able to create lists late at night of wines that I've just tasted that I want to buy later. I'm able to search out wines from new importers that I've never even heard of. I'm able to find crazy stuff from Czechoslovakia that I didn't even know I wanted. You should be on 750. It's the way to be.
Evelyn de Pomperion of Domaine du Clozel and also Chateau de Vaux, which is the same property. Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be in New York. It's a very exciting city.
Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
So you were originally teaching English and other foreign languages to adult students in Europe and the United States.
No, I was teaching French.
Oh, okay.
French as a foreign language, yes. That was my first career, if I can say so. Yes, and I had 4 children, which was also occupied a lot of my time. And then when we came back to France, my mother asked me if I would take over the domain. So that's how it happened. But that was only the second part of my life.
So you were already about 50 at that time.
Yes, exactly.
Where did the domain come from? How long had it been around?
Well, the domain has been in my family since approximately 1850. And always has belonged to women who didn't have children for some reason. So gave the domain to their niece. 3 times that happened. And the last woman was my mother before me. And she's still there, still active. But now I am the one in charge, really.
And you took over in about 2001.
That's right. Yes. So that was a very big challenge for me. Because I had drunk a lot of wine. But I had no idea how to proceed. So I just took a very interesting course that took me around the world. And it gave me an idea of what the world industry was and what I wanted to do or what I didn't want to do. That was really a very good thing from that standpoint. And it helped me make design my strategy. So I developed Onotourism because I was very impressed in South Africa and California by beautiful domains who had built chateaus and designed parks to set up nice surroundings for the wine. And I had that, so I didn't have to create anything new. And also I felt very comfortable with having guests and having visitors and smiling to them. I knew how to do that. And having a drink with them. So really, I liked the idea. And the other part of my development was export. But we already exported, even to the US, we already exported. But, you know, you have to continue and things change. And so that's how I started. And very soon, I realized that we had to be organic. I had been raised very organically. When we were children, my mother thought we shouldn't go to school too long because it was not healthy. We should be sent out to the country. We used to live in Paris. So she sent us out to our grandparents, who were absolutely wonderful people and had lovely vegetable gardens and running chicken, things that had taste. And taste was something very important in their lives. And I can remember a very strong taste of my childhood, like, you know, hot raspberries in the vegetable garden or tarragon or geese, real geese. Now, you very seldom have real geese now, real goose. So taste was always something that I was into. And when they had guests, we couldn't drink the wines, but after the meal, we used to finish the glasses. So I had an idea of what good wine was, and I had tasted some as an adult also, of course.
So you're making Savignier from the Chenin Blanc grape?
Yes, Savignier is only Chenin Blanc, normally. some people have tried other grapes, but I think it's really the Chenin Blanc that can express that landscape. And it's only Chenin Blanc allowed officially.
And what is that landscape?
Well, the landscape is very beautiful. It's three hills of schist, you know, like the slate, facing the Loire. So you have this beautiful Loire light, which you never see anywhere else. And you have the under your feet, you have this schist, which is warm. You know, it's a very black or dark green or dark red stone, and it accumulates the heat. So it's a very, very interesting climate and very good exposure. The hills face south, and you have the Loire that brings up from, it's not far from the Atlantic, so the air from the Atlantic comes up, and it's a very unique climate and exposure and lovely view too.
And what do you think about the Chenin Blanc grape in terms of its flavors?
Well, I think Chenin Blanc by itself doesn't have very characteristic flavors. It picks up the soil, picks up the landscape. If you taste the Chenin Blanc from Savonnières or from Vouvray, it's like two totally different things, which I think is very interesting. So I like to work with Chenin Blanc from that standpoint.
And do you find the aging curve of those two kinds of wines to be very different? Chenin Blanc in Vouvray.
I think they both age very well. I think it's Chenin Blanc ages very well, especially from the Loire. I don't know. I have bought a lot of South African Chenin Blanc. I don't think they age that well because they are from very hot climate and they don't have as much acidity. I think that plays a role. But in the Loire, if they are properly kept and good cork, they really age both very well. Differently, but very well.
So gradually after you took over the estate, you started introducing more organic and biodynamic practices.
Yes, I believe very much in the idea that a terroir is important, and it's something very unique. And if you want to express the terroir, you can't possibly put chemicals in it. I mean, you change things. What is interesting is to really let that soil-light combination work. That's what fascinates me. And that because that's different every year. If you use chemicals, you sort of have the same thing every year. It levels the differences. And I love this diversity.
And you have different plots. And
yes. In these hills, you have the slope. That is really schist. Then you have the top that is like a plateau at the top of the hills. And there is some sand that has been, I don't know, maybe brought by the wind or maybe it stayed from a time when the sea was there. I mean, the geologists disagree, but nobody was there, so we don't know. And then you have some sort of coulée. Coulée in Savonnières means a little valley. So you have the famous coulée de Serran, but you have other coulées. And Clos du Papillon, for example, is one of them. And in those coulées, you have lots of different kinds of stones that have been brought by the glaciers, I think. And so it's a very complex soil. So you really have three types of soil in Savonnières.
And why is it called Clos du Papillon?
Well, if you look on a map, it's not so obvious when you walk there, but if you look on a map, you have the path going up, which would be the body of the butterfly, and then you have the wings. The parcel has the shape of two wings. So the right wing, when you go up, is Beaumarle's, and the left wing is mine. But they are very different. On the right, it's more some of the sand on schist, and on my side, it's really this rocky soil.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, they're quite different.
So you have 4 hectares there.
Yeah.
It's a 12-hectare zone of the Clos du Papillon, and all of your 4 hectares are on one wing.
Yes.
And maybe Beaumarle is on the other wing?
Or? Yes, he's totally on the other wing, yeah.
So in a way, I should sort of think of them as two different vineyards.
Yeah, absolutely. They're separated by this path, so...
How do you find the characteristics of Clos du Papillon to express themselves generally in a wine?
Well, there is a lot of complexity, and it talks a lot. If you have it in your mouth, it really remains for a long, long time, and you have all kinds of different impressions. You have, it depends upon the age of the wine, of course, but you still have some citruses aromas first, and then it goes to more apricot, and then very mineral, or also grilled almonds, you know, sometimes grilled nuts. And then it goes onto honey and wax, you know, more like a Riesling. It has something in common, I think, with Riesling. So it's really very interesting. It's like a long sentence with different parts, you know, talks a lot, like me, I think.
In terms of the growing, tell me about the vine work.
The vine work, that's the most important thing. First of all, as I said, I believe really in terroir. So the soil needs to be alive. And in order to have the soil alive, in the soil you have 1 billion microorganisms per gram of earth. So you have a lot of people working there and you want them to be happy. So for them to be happy, they have to have oxygen. So you need to plow, but not deep, just sort of plow superficially the ground to bring oxygen in. And you have to have them have food. When you grow vine, you don't change your culture every year. You keep them, hopefully, for 70, 80 years. So what we do is we let grass grow between the rows, which is now quite common. But we have, at the beginning, I would seed some things, and now I just let the local plants grow. I think it's more interesting because of it. Also, these plants are going to be natural habitat for the insects, and the insects are going to be food for the birds. It's all about biodiversity and finding a balance between everybody, you know. So that grass has, we mulch it once in a while, and that is going to decay along with the when we prune the vine. Also we shrew the branches, and that feeds the microorganism of the soil. And we add a little bit of how do you call that? The fumier, from cow manure.
Oh, okay.
Cow manure, yes. The cow manure, we are very lucky. There is an organic farm nearby. So they sell us some cow manure, and I put the biodynamic preparation in it. So it stays for about 4 or 5 months before we use it. And then so it has a lot of life in it. That's very good food for the ground. So when your ground works, then the plant is happy, because when all these microorganisms work, they decay the stones, you know, and their digestion goes into the water that's running in the ground, and that goes into the roots of the plant. And that feeds the plant, and then you get into the berries this taste of the ground. You know, if you have nobody working in the ground, you get water, but you get watery berries. So it's important that all this system works.
And you've been grafting Massol vines onto old rootstock.
Yes, yes, we have done that. That's a very interesting thing, and I've been doing experimentation on that. It's tricky because many of the old vines have some disease. It's not only Esca, you know, you have many different kinds of disease. I thought my vines were wonderful, and I say, you know, we pick up this and this, but a lot of them have disease you don't know about because they still grow and produce grape, but you shouldn't reproduce that too much. So I have planted 3 hectares of young vines that I bought from the only organic nursery in France. And I take pieces to graft from these vines that are free of disease normally. So I graft them on all rootstock, yes, but also, and I have planted some rootstock also from this nursery. And I wait until they become strong enough, and then I'm going to graft them soon now. So it grows faster than when you plant just already grafted vine. It's better to have already the rootstock.
And to graft it in the vineyard.
Yes. So we need to do that because we have ESCA, like everybody else, and that's a terrible problem. You know, ESCA, nobody knows exactly how it happens. Obviously, it's a problem of, it's like a heart attack. The vine, from one day to the other, to the next, it dies. It suffocates because the little pipes where the sap goes up, all of a sudden gets, closed. Some people say that it's because of the pruning that we do too close to the wood now. Some other people say it's bad grafting in the last 20, 40, 30 years from the nurseries with this omega grafting, which is not a very natural way. You know, it's a crooked thing. So it can block the circulation of the sap. Other people say nurseries have worked on the ability of the vine to fight against mildew and oidium, but then they have weakened the other functions. And so that's how, and so some of the fungus that are on the roots, which have to be there, have been disbalanced or unbalanced. I don't know how you say that. I think it's all of that probably. But then we have dead vines and we have to replace them. That's why we have to graft.
And is it a problem in certain vineyards more than others, or with certain vine age more than others?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Very old vineyards don't have that. It's mostly from the years, I think from the 80s. 80s, yes, as of the 80s. Before that, they're free from ESCA. So there is something.
And what about some of the other parcels that you farm?
I have a generic Sauvignère, which comes from most of my parcels that are schist, and I call it La Jalousie. But Jalousie is the name of a tiny area, but it covers all this schist. It's mostly gray schist. Green schist, I'm sorry. Then I have another area, which is called Les Caillardières, and that's schist and sand. It's a very interesting wine. It's a little bit off dry sometimes. Sometimes it's dry, but it has a sort of a softness to it, even if it's totally dry. It's a velvety wine. It's very sensual. Sensuous, no, what do you say?
Sensual?
Sensual.
It seems that at the same time that you were moving towards biodynamic farming, you also started to allow more malolactic conversion of the wines in your cellar, longer ferments, and longer lees aging. Is that true?
Yes, but when you grow organically or biodynamically, you get grapes that have everything. So you don't need in the cellar to, first of all, you don't need to do anything. They just ferment evolve by themselves. You don't have to interfere. And also they already have a good balance. So you don't have to use so much sulfite, which is why the malolactic appeared. It's basically because we have decreased the use of sulfite enormously. Now, not always, but if there is a risk, if there is some rot in the harvest, which is not a bad term in our way, it means it's a very, very mature grape. Then we would put 2 grams per hectoliter on the harvest. And then nothing during the whole fermentation and élevage. So it's really very, very small doses. Then the malolactic appeared. But strangely enough, it's malolactic is done on jalousie, which is in tank and has, you know, it's bigger amount, more wine in the tank than in the barrel. It very seldom appears in the barrels for Clos du Papillon. So that's, I don't induce it. It does it or it doesn't do it. I think it's the wine finding itself the right balance. And I think it's fascinating.
And what about the lees aging?
Well, lees aging, we've always done it, but not so long. But the reason why we couldn't do it is that we didn't have air-conditioned cellar. We don't, in Savignère, you don't have underground caves or cellars. Schist is a very hard stone, and in the old time, you couldn't carve it. So we it's a building, and I put air condition. So now we can leave, you know, we can have the wine on lees for several months, even 2 years. Papillon is usually about 2 years. Yeah.
And longer fermentation, sometimes up to a year.
Yes. That I was terrified at the beginning. But it's because we don't add any yeast. It's natural yeast. And it, even though it's air conditioned, it follows the rhythm of nature. It's very funny. When winter comes early and is very cold, which happened 2 years ago, then the wine goes to sleep. Doesn't do anything until spring comes. When you hear the first bird singing, then usually you see the wine fermenting again. So this year we didn't have a winter and the fermentations went, they're over now. They've been over for about a month. But it's usually slower fermentations, yes.
So do you see a difference in the taste of the wines that you're producing today, given that there are differences year to year with the taste of the wine, say, from the 90s before you arrived?
Yes, yes. Obviously, the use of sulfite makes a big difference, first of all. The wines used to be very strict and very closed, which didn't mean that they were bad, but you had to open the bottle 2 days before drinking it or shake it or do something to open up the wine. Now, I think they are much more open. And it's fascinating when we taste in the barrels every week, you know, in the cellar during fermentation and after. It's the wine seems to be unstressed, open, happy, talking to us. I never had that before. Now I understand what's going on. Before it was just, I was terrified. I thought, ooh, is that going to be really a good wine? Now it's much more open. And I think the lees are protecting the wine. So we keep it longer on the lees because it protects the wine. It replaces the sulfite, really.
So if I were to drink one of your wines, when should I be drinking it and what should I be eating it with? The Chenin wines.
Yeah. Well, produce two. In the States, you find Jalousie and Clos du Papillon mainly, if there is very little of Les Caillardières. Jalousie, my idea is to have a wine that you can drink young because many customers like that. They like fruity aromas. So I harvest it when the berries are yellow, translucent. And at that point, when the skins are like that of the Chenin Blanc, then during the fermentation, you have some very fresh fruit aromas that are coming. And you can drink that young. Like we are now selling Jalousie 2012, and I think it's open, it's lovely. You can take it in the evening after work to relax, just enjoy. You don't have to have food with it, but you can also enjoy it. Soon, I'm sure you will have asparagus or interesting vegetables, and that's unusual that you can find a wine that can face asparagus, for example, or artichokes. So that's a nice wine for it. It's lovely with fish, white meat also. Clos du Papillon is much more sophisticated, and I harvest it about 2-3 weeks after Jalousie, when the skins have turned brown. And that means that during the fermentation, you will have more mineral taste. It's not so much the fresh fruit. It will be very different, very different range of aromas, more grilled nuts and things like that. That's really a wine, I think, for gastronomy. It's like a little spice. You know, French food is not very spicy because we always had the wine at the table. That was our spice. And for example, a lovely lobster or a very nice turbot, you know, good fish. Those have interesting structures, but they don't have very strong taste. But with the papillon, it's like giving them a little spice. It's very delicate. I think that's lovely. Also truffles. Of course, you don't eat truffles every day, but... But for example, the Papillon 2008, it smells of truffles. And it's lovely to have like veal, you know, which is a white meat, and truffles, or nice chicken and truffles, and that wine.
So what is the history of Savinière? Your property has been there since the 1450s. Mm-hmm. Your family has owned it for over 100 years. Passed down generation to generation. Not too long ago, the appellation of Savinière effectively doubled, where the neighboring area was also now Savinière. How should I understand Savinière as a place that has changed over time?
Mm-hmm. Well, we don't know exactly when vine was first planted, but we have signs that it was during the Roman time, probably 2nd century after Christ or 3rd, something like that. Then monasteries appeared all over France, and they were farming the vines. And that happened in our area. There were huge monasteries in Angers, extremely rich, and they were really farming all this area. That we know, we have archives on that. So that was early Middle Age. And then they became so rich that they... young men who wanted really to lead a spiritual life were not interested anymore in entering monasteries. They were just having a great time managing their business, not so much having a spiritual life. So gradually, monasteries declined. And at that point in Savinière, they didn't have so many monks to farm, so they gave the land to be farmed to local peasants, local people. And that's when we have our first documentation, our first archive, showing that there was a Seigneur des Vaux. You know, the name of the chateau is Château des Vaux, so it means Lord of the Valleys. And it was a little lord, no big thing. He had a tiny house, of which we still have one wall. And he had already vine, orchard, and garden. And we still have vine, orchard, and garden. So I think it's quite nice. This property was sold many, many times during the 16th, 17th, and 18th century. It was bought and sold by different people from Angers, usually bourgeois, you know, who had made money and were interested in having a good vineyard. The reputation of the vineyard, which was not named Savinière at that point, it was more named Coteau de la Loire. And Coteau de la Loire, around Savinière, Bouchemaine, and La Poissonnière, which are the two next villages, had a very good reputation. They were obviously producing very good wines. Also, what was interesting is that the Loire is right at the bottom of those hills, and the wines could go directly on ships to Nantes and then were exported for a long time. And then in the mid-19th century, my family arrived in the area, not at all for wine, but for having bought a charcoal mine in the area. My ancestor had several daughters, and he became very close friend to the owner of Savennières, who had no children. He had a daughter, but this daughter didn't have children, and she gave it to my aunt. So that's how it arrived in my family. But before that, it was bought and sold many times, and also for the other properties. So what happened when, in the 19th century, we had a big event. It was the construction of the rail track, which was supposed to replace the Loire. And so some families from Angers got very interested and built chateaus and designed parks around their chateaus in order to farm the vines and have a prestigious appearance. And so that's when all these chateaux have developed in Savennières. But now there is Domaine aux Moines, Coulée de Ciron, Château de la Roche-aux-Moines, our chateau, and Château des Pirets. Only four now are related to the vineyards. And you asked me why it developed. Well, what happened is that about 9 years ago, we decided that people could vinify grapes from Savennières, not only in Savennières and Rochefort, which is the village on the other side of the Loire, but also in the whole département of Maine-et-Loire, which is Anjou, roughly. And that changed. So many winemakers from the Léon, of course, were interested, because they couldn't have a place to vinify in Savennières, but they could farm vines and bring the grape to their own vineyard and vinify Savennières.
So that's why today there's about 35
exactly
producers making Savennières.
Yes, and that was a very smart decision, I think, because it's more interesting to be 35 than to be only 10 or 12.
And do you think that's better for the market too, in terms of establishing a presence?
Definitely. It's better for quality, because there is more competition between us. It's better for communication. To have 36 people talking about Savennières is more than having just 10. And the market, there is more, there was very little wine for sale. So now there is more, and that's better too. I think it's making it more well-known. So it's 154 hectares now.
Your mother was the president of the Savennières AOC. She was the first woman to be president of an AOC body in France. And then you are now the president of the Savennières AOC. And what are the duties involved in that? What does that entail? And how has it been to follow your mother in that footsteps?
That's a very good question. When I got elected, nowhere is written what a president should do. I asked, nobody could tell me, except there were some meetings I had to go.
Sounds like your mom did a good job of hiding the evidence then,
Well, my mother, she was very proud to be the first woman to be elected president. Her task was really to adapt Savennières to modern market. At that time, the appellation was only producing officially sweet wines. And obviously, the weather wasn't very good in the years when she was elected, and nobody could produce proper sweet wines. Everybody was asking either to add sugar, which is a dreadful thing, or to make dry wines. But it was supposed to be an exception. But the exception lasted for several years. So my mother thought this was ridiculous, and she had the decree change. So that we are allowed now to produce dry, demi-sec, or sweet. We can do the three.
And I've never had one of these. There used to be a lot of sweet Savennières called
Savennières. Old Savennières are mostly sweet.
Oh, really?
Yes.
From the 70s? And
No, at that time, it had already it changed.
I see.
Yes, but the very old ones from the 40s, the 50s, are sweet.
So I didn't know that.
They're beautiful wines, but when the year is bad, they're not beautiful wines.
So would they be similar to like a Côte de Léon, like that kind of wine?
Or? They're quite different from Côte de Léon. It's strange because it's not far, but it doesn't produce the same thing. They are more like Coteau de Lobance, which I don't think is very well known in the United States. It's another little river that's parallel to the Coteau du Léon. And it flows through Brissac and flows into the Loire also. And produces wonderful, delicate, sweet wines. And Savennières is more like that. It's a sort of a... It's not heavy. A sweet Savennières is never heavy. Because it has this acidity, I think, that's making it sort of light, a feeling that it's very light.
Sometimes I find the acidity in a Savennière to be quite stern, to mm-hmm. be, you know, quite chiseled, even more so than other, you know, Chenin Blancs from the area. Mm. But then at the same time, I feel that they're maybe in more recent vintages and less... decade or so, quite a bit of ripeness at the same time.
Yes. Everybody, you know, there are trends. Everybody has tried to harvest riper. And also the weather is warmer. So we get quickly riper, except for 2013, where it was very hard to get ripeness. And because everybody is using less sulfite, we also have more malolactic. You never had that before. You know, when that first happened in the cellar, my mother looked at me as if I had killed someone. She said, "What did you do?" Now she likes it, but at first she was shocked. We're used to those very acidic wines.
That was your mother's task, to introduce the dry wines mm-hmm. on a regular basis. Yeah. What has been your task? Is it the tourism or?
No, not so much. Tourism for my domain, but not as a president. No, my aim is to... It's like I gave myself the task of having really a common brand that everybody feels part of, responsible for. We worked on our identity. I had when I was elected, I invited everybody to my place, and we had a dinner. I make them drink a lot, and then I said, "What do you think we are?" You know, we really worked on our identity and we defined it. And now we're going to work on defining how we want to communicate on Savennières and setting up some rules that I will add to the decree, communication rules that will be common to everyone. I think it's very important that we all communicate. You know, we have the same message. Even it's wonderful that we have different wines. I don't think that matters, but it's a family. You know, in a family, you have different children, but there is a common message, and that I want this. This is my aim, and spreading the message, because it remains extremely confidential.
Does it seem sometimes that there's a lot of strong individual personalities in the Savennières appellation?
Oh, definitely. The wine has a strong personality, and the winemakers too. And I think that's very interesting. You know, that's wonderful.
So how do you get them to agree?
Well, no, that's not a problem. I think if you show to a group a very distant point, focus to, you know, that's where we want to go, then they look and they go. Honestly, it's not a problem. Of course, sometimes we discuss and we disagree on some points, but it's interesting, it's enriching, and then it's a challenge then to find a better idea. But basically, they're all very happy that, you know, we are going to have a better image and be more known and being able to sell better also.
What about the red wines that you produce, the Cabernet mm-hmm. Sauvignon, the Cabernet Franc?
Yeah. There's always been red grapes in Savennières, probably more before than now, but there is still some. It's mainly Cabernet Franc, but we have also almost 1 hectare of Cabernet Sauvignon. It's an old vine. When the weather is warm, you can produce very interesting wines. And now, recently, since the weather is getting warmer and warmer, it's great. However, with the schist, I found that it was very important not to do too much on the juice. You have to let it sit so that it works. It's like a tea. I put the grapes at this time. I put the grapes in a tank, and I let them sit for a week for Anjou Rouge, or for longer for Anjou Village, without doing anything, without adding any sulfite at all. So there is no stress. And then you get a very fruity wine for Anjou Rouge, or a more sophisticated red wine for the Anjou Village, but it's not hard tannin. You know, before you used to have a feeling that you were eating paper. Paper, not pepper. Pepper too, but pepper and paper. Now I think it's, I really reach, it took me a long time, but I think now I'm happy with what I'm doing with the red grapes. So for Anjou Rouge, it's only Cabernet Franc. And Anjou Village is a blend of Cabernet Franc and Cabernet Sauvignon.
I was surprised to learn that you make a Verdello.
Ah, that's an interesting story. The Verdello appeared in the Loire area, really, in the 18th century. You know, at that time, big ships would bring a lot of trees and plants from South America, and mainly. And they brought some of these grape varietals from abroad. And Verdello became very fashionable because it's extremely fruity. And that was in the area, we didn't have very, very fruity grapes. And so I have found an old encyclopedia where it shows that it was very fashionable, very trendy. Everybody had its Verdello. And it has remained. And in 7 years, you always had some Verdello. It was not official, but in the fall, you can see some of the leaves turn a little different. The color is not the same. So there is less and less. But I shouldn't say that. It's very unofficial. But my mother used to blend some Verdello in her wines. I didn't like that. So I kept the Verdello because it's a nice area. And I made I turned it into a different wine.
You mentioned the leaves, and I've heard you say before that you don't really like to remove leaves in general. What is your approach when you're doing canopy management towards leaves and the top of vines?
It's an experimentation. When you walk through the vineyards in July, you see that people, it's like they've been to the hairdresser. Everybody has cut the top. Obviously, you can't let vines become wild, because they would break. But if you cut the top, the plant reacts and it grows more leaves underneath. And that brings more leaves around the bunches, where it keeps humidity, if there is. And you don't want to have all these leaves around the bunches. So I have made this experimentation of wrapping the what is growing above the all the wire, you know, wrapping it around the top wire. It's relatively expensive, and my workers do not like very much to do that, but I think it's interesting because then I don't get all these extra leaves around my bunches. And if you get these extra leaves, if you cut the top, you get extra leaves, then you have to take the leaves off, which is also expensive. So that's one thing. What I did because somebody told me it also makes, I mean, the wine will taste better. So I wanted to know about that. So I have done last year in the same area, half of the parcel is wrapped and half has been cut. And we have two barrels, but it's a little bit early to tell with the difference. But next time I see you, I'll tell you.
Speaking about years, are there vintages that have really stood out for you since 2001 in terms of ease or difficulty or something you've learned for them?
Yes. Well, we had two vintages when we had frost in 2008. We had frost in March, and before the buds came out. So we thought you know, it doesn't matter. But when they came out, 2/3 were burnt. They were brown, black. So that was a big disappointment because we had very little wine in 2008. And in 2012, we had frost in early June, 2 nights in a row, -4, -5. So not everywhere in the vineyard, but it killed also a large part of the flowers and the buds. And so little harvest. So it doesn't, the vintages are good, but they are very limited. And I've learned from that it's nice to have some stock so that you can still provide wine to your clients. Because if you have nothing to sell, you know, your importers, they go to someone else. It's not easy to manage. So, yes. And then 2013 was very, very difficult in terms of harvest. Because the spring was cold and rainy, the flower came out around July 7th. And normally it's around June the 15th. So it's 3 weeks late. That means that the berries are going to be mature 3 weeks later, which really happened. So in September, it started raining, and all the berries, you started to see botrytis, but the berries were green and the skins were still thick. You couldn't possibly make proper wine with that. So I made a very hard decision. I said, we are not harvesting green grapes. I'm sorry, but we're waiting. And I was very lucky because after a week, we had lost some grapes, but we had the grapes were mature. I could harvest Jalousie properly, and I could wait for Papillon also.
And what about botrytis as a part of a dry wine in terms of a style? Is that something you embrace, to have a bit of botrytis in there?
Yes, I like, for Papillon, I don't mind having botrytis. I think it's quite interesting. As I told you, I harvest it late. So there is most of the time botrytis on those grapes. I like it. Fine, I like it. I think you have to make the wine you like.
Have you decided which female heir will be the next in line for Chateau de Vaux?
I can't decide for my children, but I don't know. I have two daughters and two sons, and they all love to drink Sauvignon. They're very supportive. Right now, they have other jobs, but, you know, my mother started when she was 50. I started when I was 50, so it's fine. I can wait a little bit. My eldest daughter is probably the one who is the more interested in vinification and culture. I think I have a son who would be very good in managing from the financial standpoint. So maybe it will be a team, which I think is nice.
Evelyn de Pontebriand of Chateau de Vaux and Domaine de Clausel, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Evelyn de Pontebriand of Domaine de Clausel.
Hey guys, it's Talitha from Vine Wine. 750 has been the greatest revolution to wine buying in the last 10 years. The ability to be able to go online, search out one item, a Palo Cortado, a new cider, some Chinon, and have all of the answers and the great bottles in front of you in 2 seconds is something that has changed my life. Makes buying easier. I'm able to create lists late at night of wines that I've just tasted that I want to buy later. I'm able to search out wines from new importers that I've never even heard of. I'm able to find crazy stuff from Czechoslovakia that I didn't even know I wanted. You should be on 750. It's the way to be.
The big news for the podcast in 2014, retail partnership, my friend. The wines we care about from the folks who are on the show offered to you by the excellent team at Vine Wine. Go to vine-wine.com for more information about what we're up to and to find the wines. That's vine-wine.com. Check it out. Cheers.
Hey, Levy, did you like the warm-up that I did today?
So good.
Oh, really? Because, you know, these days, the only way that I really know if you liked it is if you leave a comment in the iTunes.
Oh, my God. I forgot again.
You always forget. Okay, listen. Just go into iTunes, leave your comment about how much you liked it, and then I'll really know. And then I'll do it for your interview, too.
And you know what? If you're listening, you should do the same.
Leave a comment in iTunes. And that's our show today. Thanks for listening. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and our own dedicated website, alldrinktothatpod.com, no apostrophe.